Hi, everyone. Thank you for listening to K-Voice of Resistance. That's the letter K, Voice of Resistance. I'm your host, Kelly. I'm currently in Vietnam, pretending I'm Canadian, and happy to have a break from Trump's America. This is part two of the Disaster Capitalism series. I'll be back next episode with far too much to talk about, I'm sure. Until then, enjoy.
Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman was an American economist who received the 1976 Nobel Memorial Prize for Economic Sciences. Friedman wrote, quote, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around. That, I believe, is our basic function. To develop alternatives to existing policies to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable." Unquote. A people in crisis can rise up and demand their own change, a change for the better. A people under a dictator can rise up and fight for a democracy. Or a government can decimate a population's political power overnight. Large-scale shocks are frequently used to ram through despised pro-corporate and anti-democratic policies that would never have been feasible in normal times, the likes of which we've seen after 9/11, in New Orleans after Katrina. Check out Friday's show and get the detailed story on how all that went down after Katrina and was orchestrated by a man who's sad he missed the Inquisition, Mike Pence, nonetheless. We've also saw it happen in Flint with their emergency manager. It is unfolding right now in Puerto Rico with their ongoing debt crisis, which has been used to install the unaccountable Financial Oversight and Management Board, which is stripping the people of pensions and schools. Other countries are very familiar with this as well. Chile after the US-led coup of Augusto Pinochet, and I'm gonna say it, Hitler. Hitler used the Reichstag fire, Adolf, who had become chancellor just 1 month before, declared that it was part of the communist plot to overthrow the government. The next day, a law was signed essentially suspending all civil liberties, and Hitler quickly purged his political opponents from government and consolidated the Nazis' party's grip on power. I'm talking about the shock doctrine. Naomi Klein has important lessons to pass on to be sure that when a large-scale shock occurs during this administration, we are prepared. We have handled many of the small shocks headed endowed by this current government pretty well. We took to the streets, crippling and stalling the Muslim ban. And at the shock of stripping the people of healthcare, we are fighting on our feet, somewhat successfully. And the chaos of this regime has not relented for 6 months, yet we still fight. Klein writes, quote, "Donald Trump has never allowed the atmosphere of chaos and crisis to let up. Some of the chaos, like Russia investigations, has been foisted upon him, or is simply the result of his incompetence. But much appears to be deliberately created. Either way, while we are distracted by and addicted to the Trump show, clicking on and gasping at the material hand slaps and mysterious orbs, the quiet methodical work of redistributing wealth upwards proceeds apace." Unquote. She goes on to explain about Donald's massive download of executive orders. This too was done on purpose. Changes over time allow for people to react, but a bunch all at once is too much to handle. Quote, "The hope is that populations will rapidly become exhausted and overwhelmed and will ultimately swallow their bitter medicine." Unquote. All this we have been experiencing is the shock doctrine's baby cubs. It is the most that Donald can pull off behind the curtain of the shocks he is generating himself. He, Bannon, or whoever it is pulling his strings, is biding their time and waiting for a terror attack or a large-scale natural disaster or economic crisis like 2008. Whatever it is. And once that shock occurs, the beast will rear its head, and if we are not prepared, it will be too late. We need to be prepared for each possibility now. And yes, I talked about this last episode, but as I said, I believe it is the most important thing that we can learn right now. Naomi Klein has a five-step plan for us so we can resist Donald and his cronies when the time comes. Here is rule one.
What would happen if a horror like the one in Manchester took place on U.S. soil? Based on Trump's obvious fondness for authoritarianism, we can expect him to impose some sort of state of exception or emergency, where the usual rules of democracy no longer apply. Protests and strikes that block roads and airports, like the ones that sprung up to resist the Muslim travel ban, would likely be declared a threat to national security. Protest organizers would be targeted under anti-terror legislation, with surveillance, arrests, and imprisonment. With public signs of dissent suppressed, the truly toxic to-do list would quickly bubble up. Bring in the feds to pacify the streets. Muzzle investigative journalism. You know he's itching to.
You weren't called. Sit down.
The courts, who Trump would inevitably blame for the attacks, might well lose their courage. And the most lethal shock we need to prepare for? A push for a full-blown foreign war. And no, it won't matter if the target has no connection to the attacks used to justify it.
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing.
Preparing for all this is crucial. If we know what to expect, we won't be that shocked. We'll just be pissed. And that's important for step two.
Shocking.
I don't think I could sit down right now.
You mean
historic, astounding, shocking.
It's going to inject a shock to the system.
We have been going through the various shocks that we'll be faced with in this country. And any and all are possible. But unquestionably, at least one of them is inevitable. And when it happens, when the next 9/11 occurs, the next Katrina, Iraq war, Ebola, or financial crash shakes the foundations of this country, our president, his people, and the Republican Party will take advantage of our shock, our pain and distraction to tell us to stay home, to go shopping. They'll ban protesting and ban immigration, ban an entire race or religion even more than they already have. They will move funds from public services to big business. They will fulfill their most extreme ideas on their checklist because they can, while snuffing out opposition and gathering more power for the ruling party and the administration. And most importantly, the president. We ain't seen nothing yet. In previous episodes, using Naomi Klein's work on what she calls the shock doctrine, we established the likelihood and the fallout that would occur in the case of a terror attack, should we go to war, and the week before last, we did a financial crash assessment. That brings us to the likelihood of a weather shock. The GOP is ramping up gas and oil production like we haven't seen in some time. They are stripping the regulatory power of every agency possible, upping the possibility of a major industrial accident.
And now we turn to that oil rig that sank after it exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, the Coast
Guard. And then, of course, there are the hurricanes and the earthquakes in the face of poor infrastructure that are likely not to be addressed before such an event occurs.
Buildings have collapsed. There are reports from New Orleans of people trapped in buildings that have come down around them.
Klein does point out that there's a lag time of about a decade between the release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and the full resulting warming. So the very worst climate effects of this administration's policies won't likely be felt until they are out of office. That said,
we are hurtling toward the day when climate change could be irreversible.
Rising sea levels already altering this nation's coast.
China's capital is choking in its worst pollution of the year.
5% of species will become extinct.
Sea levels rising, glaciers melting.
We've already locked in so much warming that no president can complete a term without facing major weather-related disaster.
Night are attacking explosive wildfires that are tearing through Kansas, Oklahoma,
Texas, and Colorado. We were just
2 months
into the long dark night that is the Donald's reign before he was confronted with overwhelming wildfires in the Great Plains, which led to so many cattle deaths that one rancher described the event as their own Hurricane Katrina. Donald didn't spare a tweet, but you can be sure when the disaster hits the coast, where there's money to be made and building up the shores, he will be all over that disaster. Pence, too. Maybe especially. Guys, we still have to question if Trump out of office is better. I mean, Pence is terrifying. Anyways, Klein predicts, and history does seem to prove her point, disaster response services marketed specifically towards the only people that Donald believes matter, the wealthy, will be the biggest Trump-era escalation. For instance, there was a short-lived airline called HelpJet. Based in the spray tan's unfortunate side effects, Donald's beloved West Palm Beach. HelpJet disturbingly offered an array of gold-plated rescue services in exchange for a membership fee. When a hurricane was on its way, HelpJet dispatched limousines to pick up members, booked them into five-star golf resorts and spas, some were safe, then whisked them away on private jets. No standing in lines, no hassles with crowds, just first-class experience that turns a problem into a vacation. Enjoy the feeling of avoiding the usual hurricane evacuation nightmare. Bye-bye. HelpJet didn't survive. Unfortunately, HelpJet did not misjudge the market for such services. It came out in around 2006. It was simply ahead of its time. These days, in Silicon Valley and on Wall Street, the more serious high-end survivalists are hedging against climate disruption and social collapse by buying space in custom-built underground bunkers in Kansas, protected by heavily armed mercenaries, and building escape homes on high ground in New Zealand. It goes without saying that you'll need your own private jet to get there. Besides the weirdness of such services, what is worrying about the entire top-of-the-line survivalist phenomenon is that as the wealthy create their own luxury escape hatches, there is diminishing incentive to maintain any kind of disaster response infrastructure that exists to help everyone, regardless of income. Precisely the dynamic that led to enormous and unnecessary suffering in New Orleans during Katrina. This two-tiered disaster infrastructure is growing alarmingly fast. In fire-prone states such as California and Colorado, insurance companies provide a concierge service to their exclusive clients. When wildfires threaten their mansions, the companies dispatch teams of private firefighters to coat them in retardant. The public sphere, meanwhile, is left to further decay. And California! Liberal progressive California provides a glimpse of where this is all headed. For its firefighting, the state relies on upwards of 4,500 prison inmates who are paid $1 an hour when they are on the fire line, putting their lives at risk battling wildfires, and about $2 a day when they're back at camp. By some estimates, California is saving $1 billion a year through this program. This is the picture of what happens when you mix austerity politics with mass incarceration and climate change.
So, remember when this happened?
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
As a reaction to this?
Today we've had a national tragedy. Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country.
Regardless of this.
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing!
We've been talking on this show about the various ways in which this administration will seize upon a national shock in order to enact the more insidious parts of their agenda, strip the people of their power, and crush any opposition, etc. We thought the Patriot Act was bad. Just wait until Donald, Bannon, and Jeff Bosesh fulfill their dream board agenda and get a shot at it. There are many ways a government can respond to a terrorist attack. They can ban outdoor activity, restrict the media, infringe on privacy, insert military into our everyday lives, round up large groups of people, clamp down on freedom of speech, the right to protest, arrest those who would organize a protest or opposition, and the media. Good luck. The most lethal way, however? It seemingly won't matter if the country is responsible for the attack or not. We have a Muslim ban right now that targets countries that are not connected to terrorist attacks on our shores. Donald has a grab bag of countries in which he could, if he so choose to, go to war with. They include, but by no means are limited to, Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and most perilously, Iran. And then there's, of course, North Korea.
Let me be very clear. The policy of strategic patience has ended. We're exploring a new range of diplomatic, security, and economic measures. All options are on the table.
That's our Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, T-Rex, who has criticized the U.S. sanctions on Russia and was awarded Russia's Order of Friendship by Putin in 2013, who is also in the news right now because the Treasury fined ExxonMobil $2 million for violating sanctions that the Obama administration imposed on Russian entities in 2014 over Russia's annexation of Crimea, which, were we not living in the Upside Down, would be a news-dominating scandal for weeks. But
thanks to the goddamn Electoral College handing a
corrupt bigot the presidency, it is an afterthought. If that, anyhow, there are all kinds of reasons why people around Donald would want to go to war.
particularly those who came straight from the defense sector, like our potential new Secretary of the Army, in addition to the fact that we have a
crazy lunatic 70-year-old man baby.
Thank you, Anna DeVaro, in charge of the missiles and desperate for praise.
I think it is amazing optics.
This could be good for infrastructure spending, could be good for tax reform, could be good for health reform in the future. So it can maybe kind of unite the country a little bit more.
We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, "I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons." And they are beautiful pictures of fearsome armaments making what is for them a brief flight over to this airfield.
Again, that followed the strike against Syria in April after the
stunt, a glorified fireworks show which did nothing to impede the Assad regime from using, again, chemical weapons against its own people. It was a stunt that did nothing to impede the Trump regime from using, again, propaganda weapons against its own people.
Thank you, Keith Olbermann. And recognize that the strike was ordered without congressional approval and therefore illegal, according to some experts. Yet senators, Republican and Democrat alike, fell all over themselves to praise him as well.
We fired what is reported to be $94 million worth of missiles, and we didn't even put a hole in the runways. And nobody noticed, because 79 senators publicly said this stunt, this meaningless, dangerous, cynical, exploitative, bullshit stunt that didn't even slow Assad's bombers down was a good thing.
His inner circle also immediately seized on the opportunity and pointed to the attacks as proof that there was nothing untoward going on between the White House and Russia.
Right.
But there is more to this possibility of war that ultimately boils down to a trigger for many wars. If it's not religion, it's oil. Gas Goliaths, like Exxon, have seen their profits plummet since the price of gas has gone down. So when you take T-Rex Tillerson, who, again, I can't say enough, was at Exxon for 41 years, his entire working life, and ExxonMobil has agreed to pay him a retirement package worth a staggering $180 million. And then take Russia. Donald's cuddle buddy, Vladimir Putin's Russia, is little else economically than a vast petrostate. After Saudi Arabia, Russia is the world's leading exporter of natural gas and the second largest exporter of oil. What we have here is a bitter incentive for war. There is no faster or more effective way to drive up the price of oil, especially if that war is in an oil-producing country. Oilprice.com explains that in July 2008, oil prices reached over $136 a barrel due to global concerns that the wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the main reasons that oil prices rose so precipitously during the time period was due to the fact that suppliers were unable to convince buyers that they would be able to properly deliver the oil. In comparison, today, oil is going for under $50 per barrel, if not $30 a barrel. Russia has been in an economic crisis since the price of oil collapsed, and the shirtless strongman's weakness is revealed. You might have heard about that little half-a-trillion-dollar deal that the Russian bear and our T-Rex made together, Putin and Tillerson. Around 2012, when T-Rex was with Exxon and made a deal to drill in the Arctic that suffered an early death because of mean Obama's sanctions against Russia. Now, we know our current president would lift those sanctions yesterday if he could, and it remains a constant possibility. So, let's say he did. The deal was made when oil prices were soaring, and these days, not so much. Arctic drilling is expensive. Experts estimate it to cost about $75 per barrel to drill in the Arctic. So gas prices would need to be going over $100 per barrel, if not more, to make the effort worthwhile. Something environmentalist and I have found solace in. But all of this leads us to a pretty grim conclusion indeed. The possibility of war may be better characterized as an inevitability. The U.S. Geological Society estimates that there could be 90 billion barrels of oil beneath the Arctic Ocean. Once Donald takes this country to war, he will trigger a global feeding frenzy for new high-risk, high-carbon fossil fuel extraction from the Arctic to the tar sands, bringing about a climate calamity that is sure to take us past the tipping point. Averting war is in a very real way a climate change issue. Yeah, funny enough, in the end, Donald going to war over oil and profit may be the most
presidential thing he has done after all.
What did Iraq have to do with what?
The attack on the World Trade Center.
Nothing!
Naomi Klein, who wrote The Shock Doctrine, has advice on how to fight against this administration should a national shock occur, such as a terror attack or war. The first step is knowing what's coming. The second step was to defy the bans he were to put out. If he says not to protest and not to go in the street, we go in those streets. And here is the third step.
Know your history. Throughout U.S. history, national crises have been used to suspend constitutional protections and attack basic rights. After the Civil War, with the nation in crisis, the promise of 40 acres and a mule to freed slaves was promptly betrayed. In the midst of the pain and panic of the Great Depression, as many as 2 million people of Mexican descent were expelled from the United States. After the Pearl Harbor attacks, around 120,000 Japanese Americans were jailed in internment camps. If an attack on U.S. soil were perpetrated by people who were not white and Christian, we can be pretty damn sure that racists would have a field day. And the good folks of Manchester recently showed us how to respond to that.
People in Manchester don't stand with your xenophobia and racism.
From U.S. trends to world trends, Europe, Australia and North America are erecting increasingly elaborate and privatized border fortresses to seal themselves off from people fleeing for their lives. Fleeing, quite often, as a direct result of forces unleashed primarily by those fortressed emerald cities. Whether it was predatory trade deals, unnecessary oil-driven wars, or ecological disasters intensified by climate change, largely accelerated by those wasteful and reckless first-world continents. Naomi Klein makes the point, the hottest and driest places on Earth, Pakistan to Libya, Yemen, Somalia, and Iraq, are on fire with the most intense conflict in the world. Drought and famine are the kerosene to conflict, and the people flee. They flee starvation, abuse, and bombs. A foreign army, they flee from their homes desperate and empty-handed. How easy is it for large majorities to not see the humanity in these people, even as over 1,300 people have drowned in the Mediterranean trying to reach European shores, many of them children and toddlers and babies. They drag themselves to the shores, to the borders of another country, of any other country, having lost many along the journey, only to be put in a prison camp in Australia on the Nauru or Manus Islands, under conditions that numerous humanitarian organizations have described as tantamount to torture, or to the massive, recently demolished migrant camp in France, nicknamed the Jungle. Those in the Emerald Cities can rationalize and dismiss and ignore. It is an echo of the way Katrina's abandoned people were categorized in right-wing media as animals, or the homeless lining the streets in every city of America are kicked, despised, and left to rot, shoved out of the way no more than a nuisance, a blight on the scenery on the drive to work. Globally, the dramatic rise of right-wing nationalism, anti-black racism, Islamophobia, and straight-up white supremacy over the past decade continues, spurred on by these global trends. We see more and more people shot out of the Emerald Cities, out of the green zones, if you will, in society's search for justification. That justification comfortably falling to the, they deserved it, they weren't worthy, they deserved their fate. The only way to justify such barbaric forms of exclusion is to double down on theories of racial hierarchy that tell a story about how the people being locked out of the global green zones deserve their fate, they deserve what's coming to them. Whether it's Trump casting Mexicans as racist or bad hombres, or Syrian refugees as quasi-terrorists, or prominent conservative Canadian politician Geely Leitich proposing that immigrants be screened for Canadian values. Or successive Australian prime ministers justifying those sinister island detention camps as a humanitarian alternative to death at sea. The Republican Palace in central Baghdad, where security is very tight and all occupants are screened for entry. This is the only place in the city where Westerners from the UK or the USA can walk around the town unarmed and in relative safety from assassination, kidnapping, and car bombs. A red sector generally refers to conditions that exceed safety limits. A region that is dangerous or forbidden. We talked on Tuesday about a recent and alarming uptick in concierge disaster prep that are removing the wealthy among us, the only ones among us for which policy is made, and is removing them from the need for public services and protection. There is also less reason for the big winners of our economy to embrace the demanding policy changes required to prevent an even warmer and more disaster-prone future, which might help to explain the Trump administration's determination to do everything possible to accelerate the climate crisis. Their children, and indeed their class, will be just fine. And their wealth and their connections will protect them from the worst of their shocks to come. Oh, they will lose some beachfront property, sure. But nothing that can't be replaced with a new mansion or higher ground. Naomi Klein makes the point that, quote, in an age of ever-widening income inequality, the significant cohort of our elites are walling themselves off, not just physically, but also psychologically, mentally detaching themselves from the collective fate of the rest of humanity. This secessionism from the human species, if only in their own minds, liberates the rich not only to shrug off the urgent need for climate action, but also to devise even more predatory ways to profit from current and future disasters and instability. What we are hurtling toward is a world demarcated into fortified green zones for the super rich, red zones for everyone else, and black sites for whoever doesn't cooperate. Unquote. We are the country that built itself on the backs of slaves stolen from their homelands, on the land we stole from slaughtered indigenous peoples in the name of wealth and comfort, a country that has never given such abused peoples a full seat at the table since. We are a country that has never atoned for our sins. We are a country that will have no problem dissolving into an American Baghdad once things get bad enough. Us in the red zones and all those who fight day and night to keep us in our place and lower in the green. Trump is just one early and vicious manifestation of that unraveling, but he is not alone, and he won't be the last. We have looked closely at the large-scale shocks that are president is looking to harness in order to ram his despised pro-corporate and anti-democratic policies that would have never been feasible in normal times, and the realities of such shocks make it hard to see a future that ends well for us. I'll let Naomi Klein bring this grim assessment home. Quote, we have long imagined the ends of our society, that the walled city, the wealthy few live in relative luxury, while the masses outside war with one another for survival is pretty much the default premise of every dystopian sci-fi movie that gets made these days. Or in Western religions, in their grand narratives of great floods washing the world clean and a chosen few selected to begin again, we have collectively imagined this extreme winners and losers ending in our species so many times that one of our most pressing tasks is learning to imagine other possible ends to the human story in which we come together in crisis rather than split apart, take down borders rather than erect more of them. Wasn't that the point of that dystopian art? Was never to enact as a temporal GPS showing us where we are inevitably headed. The point was to warn us, to wake us. We have it in our power to begin the world over again. So said Thomas Paine many years ago, neatly summarizing the dream of escaping the past that is at the heart of both the colonial project and the American dream. The truth, however, is that we do not have this godlike power of reinvention, nor did we ever. We must live with the messes and the mistakes that we have made, as well as within the limits of what our planet can sustain. But we do have it in our power to change ourselves, to attempt to right past wrongs, to repair our relationships with one another and with the planet we share. It is this work that is the bedrock of the resistance. Unquote. And that is where we face our most difficult challenge in the resistance. It is not stopping something in the moment or simply being reactionary when needed, but stepping up and stepping out. We need to create something new, something better, to create a different way. We cannot count on others to take us there. We are the ones. And now is our time. Thank you for listening. You can find my show on crabdiving.com, that's one word, crabdiving.com, under the K-Voice tab, or download my show as a podcast wherever it is you get your podcast. You can also find my show on Citizen Truth, at citizentruth.org. Follow me on Twitter at KellyTheVoice, or on Facebook at K-Voice of Resistance. All right, take care of yourselves out there, and as always, resist.